If you were to visit New Hampshire in the fall, you would likely be awestruck by the color of the reds and oranges of the autumn leaves. Rolling hills that look like soft mountains that you could play in, and cold creeks trickle by as you immerse yourself in a town that holds histories and stories beyond belief. The soft padding of your feet walking you through an area may give you a chill that you think is just from the cool air. But hidden here, in its history, are acts of vengeance, so cruel and inhumane, and yet this woman was idolized. A statue was erected, and when you first see it, you might not think much of the position of her hands. But as you walk closer, what is there becomes more clear. For this woman, who had been kidnapped, took her life back with violence. And this towering statue, as you approach, becomes something more sinister. You see, in one hand, she holds a hatchet, and in the other, her granite fingers are clutching a fistful of human scalps. Welcome back to Tragedy with a View. I am your host, Kayla, and surprise, welcome to the very first episode of what I'm calling Free Solo Friday of Tragedy with a View. And just really quick, I want to explain what to expect here. If you listened to the last episode, you probably already heard me mention that scheduling time to record episodes when you have a kind of revolving door of co-hosts is difficult. And I really enjoy having different friends and different guests come on and do these episodes with me, because you get a variety of different personalities and a variety of different thoughts, and it just brings a little bit of unpredictability and new information to each episode. And I really, really like that. And I want to keep that format for the majority of my episodes. With that, because of the difficulty with scheduling and kind of getting together for the main episodes, I want to be able to give you more without potentially taking it away later because life gets crazy or something happens. And so the meat in the middle was doing an episode by myself. And I hope you enjoy them. If you don't, you're welcome to communicate that. And if there's an overwhelming number of you who don't enjoy me just talking to you by myself, I'll take that in consideration and, you know, maybe do away with these episodes at some point. But we're just trying something new here, and you're going to be getting these episodes on the second Friday of every month. And very quickly, I want to remind you, we have merch launching on February 1st. I am still working on trying to figure out Patreon members if I'm able to get you that link early. But if I can't, I am absolutely going to be giving you guys a discount code. So definitely head there if you haven't already. Additionally, Patreon members are going to get an episode on February 1st. And then every other month, on the first of the month, Patreon members are going to get an exclusive episode. If I have the capacity to do more, you potentially will get an episode on odd months as well. And one more thing before we get into this episode, I had someone reach out to me and ask if I could tell like some funny or kind of lighthearted stories. And because Tragedy with a View doesn't fully encompass that, I'm sorry, the name just kind of brings the mood down. I thought that maybe intermittently, this is not going to take the place of current episodes, but intermittently, maybe every couple of months or maybe once a quarter, if you guys have a funny story of something that occurred on the trails or in the outdoors or in nature, please feel free to write in. I'm going to call them campfire confessionals, and would love to hear what stories you have. And maybe those are something that I can share in addition to the other kind of more funny stories I find online. You can send me an email at tragedywithaview@gmail.com, and I'll get something put together here pretty quickly if I'm able to. So we're going to get started on this episode, which is the story of Hannah Dustin. And this is a doozy. We're going to be talking a little bit about racism, and because that is a topic that is so deep that I can't possibly talk about it by myself, let alone in one episode, I'm going to just try to keep to the facts about this story as much as possible. And it's not because I don't want to have the conversation, but just that it wouldn't really be much of a conversation if it's just me here. Hannah was born in Haverhill, Massachusetts on December 23rd, 1657. She was born as Hannah Emerson to Michael and Hannah Emerson. And a real quick side note, I think it's so cool when a woman's name gets passed down. Hannah was the oldest of the 15 kids her parents had, and their father was abusive. And while physical abuse was more widely accepted at this time, he was so violent towards Hannah's younger sister, Elizabeth, in particular, that when she was 11 years old, he was tried and found guilty and had to pay a fine for his actions toward her. The Emerson family was looked down on as outcasts because Elizabeth had illegitimate children twice. The first at 20, she had a girl whom she named Dorothy, and the second was a set of twins who died either before or at birth. Because no one knew that she was pregnant the second time, and she labored at the foot of her parents' bed in silence, she hid them in a tree after she found out that they were dead. When the twins' bodies were discovered, Elizabeth was convicted, tried, hung, and then buried in an unmarked grave. The family also had multiple cousins who were prosecuted at the Salem witch trials, which didn't help the family's reputation. At 20, Hannah married Thomas Dustin, whose name is also spelled as Dustan, Dustin, and Durston. They would go on to have 13 children. However, only 9 of them made it past infancy, which I think is pretty good for that time period. When Hannah was born, Massachusetts was in the midst of several disputes, either with the French in Canada or the Native Americans. Then King Philip's War from 1675 to 1676 rocked through and effectively killed off the Native American population, decreasing the tribe numbers by up to 80%. To follow was King William's War from 1688 to 1697, but this time the Native Americans had the French Canadian on their side. Some tribes were more friends than enemies, but those who fell strongly on the enemy side would fight for their land by charging into settlements and setting fire to barns, homes, and businesses, killing colonists who fought against them, and capturing others. Those captured were later returned to their families for ransom, or they would be quote-unquote adopted into families in order to replace the numbers that the tribes had lost in King Philip's War. Additionally, as I already mentioned, this time period falls right in line with the Salem witch trials, which, as we know, was just chaos. The Abenaki tribe, which was actually a compilation of the Abenaki, the Mi'kmaq, the Obanaket, the Passamaquoddy, and the Maliseet, formed together and called themselves the people of the Dawnland. And They did this to first protect all of their tribes against the Iroquois, which then transitioned to the settlers of the Americas. During the King William's War, the Abenaki would completely destroy 11 towns and partially destroy 13 others. And a real quick note on this, I pulled this information from a book by Captivating History, and they heavily talk about the violent ways that Native Americans would attack settlers, but they never really acknowledge the violent acts or the lands and the homes stolen from the natives by these same settlers. So it just felt like a very one-sided story. During the King William's War, there were many peace offerings and treaties that were signed and then just completely ignored and tossed out, which led to a lot of resentment and retaliation and ultimately a refusal to work with or trust the other side. On March 15th, 1697, Hannah was bedbound after complications giving birth to Martha, her and Thomas's eighth child, 6 days prior. Thomas, who had been working in the fields when he heard a commotion, suddenly slammed through the door and ushered their seven older kids out the door as the Abenaki attacked the town of Haverhill. Left behind was Hannah, Martha, and Mary Neff, who, depending on what source you read, will say that she was either Hannah's maid or neighbor, but she could have also been both. Mary grabbed Martha and sprinted out the door, but was quickly caught, with Hannah not long after being captured. Hannah, in the rush she was in, was only able to put on one shoe. Meanwhile, the Abenaki gave chase to Thomas and their seven children, who successfully took refuge in a garrison, which is kind of like a protected shelter. Thomas had a gun with him and fought the Abenaki by riding his horse in an arc back and forth behind his children as they ran for safety. The natives attacked and killed 27 people of Haverhill, 15 of them were children, and captured 10 others. They burned down 6 homes, including that of Hannah's and Thomas's. Once captured, Hannah, Martha, and Mary, along with a group of other captives, were herded north towards Canada. In the 2 weeks the group traveled on foot, they traveled about 100 miles to an island on the Merrimack and Kentucky rivers. Early on, Mary had been carrying Martha for Hannah, and because she was trying to be careful with her, she walked slowly and frequently fell behind the group. Soon, Martha started crying and wouldn't stop. In response, their captors tore the baby from Mary's arm and slammed the baby against a tree, killing her. Meanwhile, Hannah could only stand and watch in horror. In their way, the captors continually told them that once they reached their camp, they would be stripped of their clothes and forced to run the gauntlet, which, if you are not aware what running the gauntlet is, it is when you are forced to run through a group of people that are lined up in two rows. So you run between these two lines of people, and those people will have sticks and other weapons that they will use to hit and strike you with. Some would throw stones and others would have clubs to strike a person with, and this is a form of capital punishment. In many circumstances, if you refuse, you would be killed because this showed that you were a coward and not worth bringing into their families. After reaching the island on April 30th, Hannah and Mary were placed with a family of natives that included 2 men, 3 women, and 7 children. Also included in this family group was 14-year-old Samuel Leonardson, who had been abducted from his home in Worcester, Massachusetts, 18 months prior. Depending on the account you read, some will say that one of the men of this family was the man who killed Martha, and others will say that none of these people were the original captors. Nonetheless, one night as the family slept, Hannah, Mary, and Samuel stood over them, tomahawks in hand. The Native Americans had taught Samuel how to use the tomahawks and how to skin animals, and he, being befriended by Hannah, taught her and Mary the same. On a count of three, they attacked. Well, Hannah and Samuel did. Mary found herself unable to bring the tomahawk down on the head of her captors. Samuel stopped his attack after one. Hannah continued, viciously moving down the line and coming down hard on the faces of those whose eyes widened at the sight of their own weapons being used against them. In the end, a boy and the elderly woman escaped injured. However, the rest were dead where they laid. Hannah, Mary, and Samuel then stole a canoe and started down the river, heading toward freedom. But Hannah then realized that not only was the story of what they just did hard to believe, but they would likely be rewarded if she had proof. So she turned them back, scalped those she and Samuel had killed, and returned to the river. The trio would travel on the river only at night and hid during the day. The last day, they ran on foot since the river would not take them any closer to their home. Hannah would receive 50 pounds from the Massachusetts General Assembly for the scalps that she collected. Later, Hannah told her story to Puritan minister Cotton Mather, and while she never wrote down her tale, he did. He then republished it twice more between 1697 and 1702. His thoughts, however, were greatly skewed as he believed the natives were being used by the devil and highlighted the emotionally gruesome ways the Native Americans would attack settlers. More notable, however, is the amount of detail he documented about Martha's killing. Yet he didn't mention that six of those killed by Hannah were children. After his last publication, Hannah's story was all but forgotten. That is, until the United States government needed a way to handle the Indian problem. In the 1820s, some had started to realize that Native Americans were people too, just trying to live their lives in peace on their own lands. While treaties had been signed in the East, the West was still open and the government used Hannah's story as a way to spark anger and action. For if this lovely innocent woman and her baby had been captured, surely it would happen again. Quickly, the details of the six children she murdered were omitted and the gruesome details of how Martha died were released over and over. The emotions Hannah's story elicited from listeners added fuel to the flame, and soon settlers viewed natives again as savages. Her story, while violent and cruel in every way, was used as propaganda, and clearly those wielding it had an agenda. The remembrance of Hannah became focused on how her story hid and permitted the violence the settlers committed when taking Native Americans' lands and homes, and never told the entire truth. Hannah is likely the very first woman to have public monuments built for her, and you heard that right, monuments. Three different statues were built to celebrate her actions and to stand as a warning against the Native Americans. In 1861, a marble column was put up in Haverhill, Massachusetts, with her story as told by Mather on the sides. Atop sat an eagle, and the sides also showed photos of bows, arrows, a musket, a tomahawk, and a scalping knife. But this monument would be removed 4 years later because the builder didn't pay for it in full, and it was resold as a Civil War monument. In 1874, so nearly two centuries after her kidnapping and vengeance occurred, a 25-foot-tall statue was put up in Concord, New Hampshire, to honor Hannah and her tirade against the natives. And this is the one where she holds the tomahawk in one hand and the fistful of scalps in the other. Last, Haverhill erected another statue for Hannah, this one in 1879 with a tomahawk in one hand and her other hand with a finger outstretched like she was pointing blame, and she only has one shoe on her feet. The statues, while initially raised to send a message to the natives, are now the center of the controversies that have shifted a bit in recent years. Today, groups have made demands to remove the statues, and questions have been raised. Do we celebrate this part of history, and do we honor and praise a person who murdered 6 children? Hannah's story is recognized to be used to fuel hate against Native Americans, and as some have pointed out, this also fuels racist agendas. A careful balance is needed between telling stories in the best way we know how, while also expunging the present and future of the hatred that story previously incited. Denise Pollott, who is the lead female speaker of the Kawasak Band of the Penacock Abenaki, has been trying to find that balance while staying painfully aware that the statues are a source for conversation and provide an opportunity to tell the truth of what happened on these lands. Those who want to keep the statues in place claim Hannah was acting in self-defense and that the simple removal of the statue won't solve any of the problems. The statues have been vandalized multiple times, and many feel that Hannah, while acting horrendously, wasn't targeting the Native Americans. In fact, the claim is made that if the French had captured her, she would have attacked the French in the same vicious manner. Many agree that it wasn't her response to her captors that isn't as offensive. It is how her story was portrayed and retold. It was the use of her actions to justify the mistreatment of natives, not just in the area Hannah lived, but all over the country. And to be clear, her actions were still terrible and outrageous. No one in current day is outwardly accepting what she did as an acceptable response. While the statue in Haverhill is being fought over by arguments from every angle, the memorial site in New Hampshire is making some pretty big changes. First, changing the name from the Hannah Dustin Memorial Site to Unity Park Endekina, which in Abenaki means our land. And second, new signs are being placed to explain the story from every angle, to portray the discrepancies and to explain rather than destroy history. In the end, our history needs to be shared and told to the most accurate representation possible to make sure that we don't lose and forget where our country has come from. We are a product of the social, historical, and cultural times in which we live. History is often oppressed and often tried to be erased. Erasing Hannah's story in an effort to dismiss her actions would also erase the actions she took against the Native Americans. To end, I agree that we should do our best to tell the real, complete stories that shaped our nation into what we see today. Expanding on what we know to be true will foster relationships and understanding in significant ways beyond what textbooks and conversations we have in history class hold. I hope you enjoyed the story and take a moment to appreciate that history, while sometimes awful, has led us to where we are today. We are always changing and always growing. Thank you for listening. Please take a moment to rate and subscribe from wherever you listen to Tragedy with a View. To get access to ad-free episodes, bonus content, and more, please join us on our Patreon. The link will be in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and to share a story of your own, send us a campfire confessional email at tragedywithaview@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.